17. On the way back to Pleiku, in a helicopter flying over the central highlands, Frankie heard the familiar pop-pop-pop of gunfire. The chopper swooped and swerved, leaned so far to the left she slid into Rye. He put an arm around her, held her close.
"Hold on, baby. Charlie doesn't like our bird,"
he yelled to be heard over the noise. He took his helmet out of his bag and put it on her, tightening the straps beneath her chin. She grinned at him.
"Oh, that will save my life?"
He laughed.
"Let me be a hero, will ya?"
Later, as the helicopter descended toward the helipad, Rye pulled Frankie close and kissed her. Frankie unhooked his helmet and handed it back to him. With one last look that seared his smile into her memory, she grabbed her travel bag and jumped off the helicopter and stood on the helipad, looking up.
"Be safe, Riot!"
Rye took a seat in the open door by the gunner, smiling at her as the helicopter lifted into the air. He yelled something she couldn't hear, waved goodbye. The helicopter veered sharply sideways, headed north, and swooped down close to the jungle canopy. Pop, pop, pop. She saw sparks of light hit the Huey's broadside. The gunners shot back as the bird veered sharply away. Another shot, sparks, the rat-a-tat-tat of the gunners shooting back. The Huey maneuvered swiftly. Orange bits streaked through the sky. The shooting stopped, leaving silence in the jungle and the softening sound of the helicopter's rotors as it flew away. Safe. This time. From now on, until she and Rye both landed safely back in the U.S., she knew there would always be a piece of her that was afraid. April 10th, 1968. Dear Frankie, I don't know how to write this. My brother, Will, was killed by the Oakland police this week, a shootout with the Black Panthers. He was shot 10 times even though he'd surrendered. I'm devastated. Heartbroken. Pissed off. I need my best friend here with me to keep me steady. Love you. B. April 24th, 1968. Dear Barb, I know your grief. Losing a brother is losing a piece of yourself, your history. I'm sorry is a shitty, useless, not enough thing to say, but what else is there? If I still believed in a benevolent God, I'd send you prayers. Stay strong for your mom. Find a way to honor and remember him. Love, F. June 16th, 1968. Dear Mom and Dad, I can't believe that another Kennedy has been assassinated. What is wrong with the world? Things are getting worse over here, too. Morale among the troops is the worst I've ever seen it. Between the assassination of MLK and Robert Kennedy and the protests back home, everyone is mad as hell. If you wonder how we can lose a war, imagine how the guys fighting it feel. And LBJ just sends more and more untrained kids to fight. The ORs here are always full. The sound of dust-offs landing is becoming constant. We used to have days off, times the OR was quiet. Not so many anymore. Don't believe everything you read. Our boys are dying every day. I see more and more soldiers stumbling in from the boonies, their minds broken, their nerves shot to hell. They walk through the bush, snipers everywhere, and step on hidden mines and blow up 5 feet away from their buddies. It's awful. And yeah, a few of them are high. Heroin is its own horror. So is the way they look when they find their way to the hospital. I can't fix them all. No one can. But I'm doing my best. I want you to know that. I am making a difference and helping to save lives. Thanks for all the letters and for the care packages. I really needed more film. And who knew you'd miss Twinkies and Pop-Tarts in a war? Love you. F. On a still, sweltering evening on the 4th of July of 1968, Frankie stood beneath the bright lights in the OR, stitching up a minor abdominal wound. Sweat dampened her mask and cap, slid down her back. The temperature today had gone past 102 degrees. When she finished, she peeled off her bloody gloves and dropped them into a garbage can.
Two soldiers stumbled into the OR on bare, bloody feet, carrying a man on a litter between them. The men looked sucked dry, hollowed out, sunken eyes, sunken cheeks, the thousand-mile death stare that Frankie had begun to recognize as the look of men who'd been out in the boonies too long, trekking, trying to avoid landmines, looking for Charlie in every shadow and bush. Constant fear turned a man inside out. Frankie grabbed some masks and handed them to the men.
"We carried him 30 miles," one of the men said. "We broke out. Too late."
So, prisoners of war. No wonder they looked so beaten, both physically and mentally. Word was that the NVA kept American POWs in cages too small for them to stand up in, and that they tortured them. "How long were you prisoners?"
3 months,
the other one said. He was wearing a necklace made of amputated fingers and ears strung on a leather cord. Trophies, probably, taken from their North Vietnamese captors when they escaped. It was the kind of thing she'd seen more of in the past few months as the fighting had heated up. It was profoundly disturbing, sickening, a terrible sign that the soldiers' minds were being as broken by war as their bodies. She couldn't imagine what they'd been through or what they'd done to escape, or how hard it had been to carry this wounded man for 30 miles through the booby-trapped jungle on bare feet. The man on the litter had an infected bullet wound in his chest that oozed pus. Frankie didn't need to touch his forehead to diagnose a raging fever. She could see it in his eyes, smell it on him. Frag wounds had torn up his arms and neck. He could barely breathe, kept gasping. Something must be swollen or lodged in his airway. He was going to die, and soon. Frankie called out to Dr. Morse, who came over, took one look at the kid on the litter, and said,
"Expectant, McGrath."
"Put a trach in, Doc," she said. "Let him breathe easy, at least."
"Waste of time, McGrath. Go find someone you can save."
One of the soldiers said, "Wait, we just humped through the boonies for a week with Fred." Frankie knew that the doc was right. This kid wasn't going to make it, and the OR was crowded with casualties they could save. But she couldn't turn her back on these men and what they'd suffered. She pointed to an empty table. "Set him there, boys."
"What are you doing, McGrath?"
Dr. Morse asked. "Letting him say goodbye to his friends and die in peace."
"Be quick. I've got a sucking chest wound that needed you 10 minutes ago."
The men set the wounded soldier on the table. Frankie cut off what was left of his fatigues. Yanking her cart close, she changed into clean gloves and wiped his neck with antiseptic solution. Holding her scalpel, she took a breath to steady herself, then made a small cut between the thyroid and cricoid cartilages and inserted a breathing tube. The dying man took a deep, wheezing breath. Frankie saw relief come into his eyes. How long had he been fighting just to breathe?
"We got out, Fred," one of his buddies said. "Took 5 of those fuckers with us."
Frankie took hold of Fred's hand, held it in hers, and leaned close, whispering, "You must be a good man. Your friends are here." His buddies kept talking about his girl, the baby waiting for him back home, how he had saved their lives in that hellhole. Frankie saw Fred take his last breath, felt the way he went still. "He's gone," she said tiredly, looking at the two bloodied, dirtied men in front of her. "You gave him a chance, though." She wouldn't be surprised if those death stares would be a part of them forever now. Men staring into a world they no longer were a part of, no longer comprehended, a world where the ground beneath your feet exploded. Another kind of casualty. She thought of other men who had grabbed her hand over the past few months, begged her to answer the question, "Who will want me like this?" And it struck her that it wasn't just physical wounds that soldiers would take home from Vietnam. From now on, all of them would have a deep understanding of both man's cruelty and his heroism. A medic shoved through the OR doors and yelled,
"45 Vietnamese villagers coming in! Napalm!"
and left again. Napalm. "Go to the mess," she said to the two soldiers as she stripped out of her gloves. "Get some chow, take a shower, and get rid of that damned necklace." She yelled for someone to take the dead man away, Then she found Margie, and together they pushed the few OR patients to one side and gathered empty beds to turn the OR into an overflow burn unit. 2 minutes later, a flood of villagers hit the OR, most of whom had been burned beyond recognition. Frankie knew it was the same scene in the ICU and pre-op and on the wards. Napalm, a jellied firebomb used in flamethrowers by the U.S. to clear out foxholes and trenches and dropped in bombs by U.S. planes, had become common in these first few months of her second tour. More and more of its victims were coming into the OR. Most of them were villagers. Tomorrow they'd be flown to the third field, a real burn unit, but few would survive until then. The few who did would wish they'd died. These burns were like nothing else on Earth. The gel-fueled firebomb mixture stuck to its target and didn't stop burning until nothing was left. Frankie moved from bed to bed, applying topical ointments and debriding dead tissue, but there was so little she could do here to help them heal, and nothing to ease their tremendous pain. By 1000 hours, she was exhausted, and the burn victims were still arriving. She could hear Margie and Dr. Morse and some medics talking to each other, rolling carts, yelling for ointment. The next bed held a woman, impossible to tell if she was young or old. Her body was burned from head to toe. The black, charred flesh still smoked. Beside her, tucked protectively against her body, was a baby. Frankie stopped. For a split second, the horror overwhelmed her. She had to take a deep, steadying breath. The infant was still alive. "Dear God," Frankie said under her breath. "How could that be?" With care, she picked up the infant, who couldn't be much older than 3 months. "Hey, little one," Frankie said, her voice breaking. Thin white ribs shone through the gaping wounds and burns on her chest. She found a chair and sat down. The OR was a cacophony of screaming, moaning, crying casualties, and shouting medics and nurses and doctors. The sound of wheels rolling on concrete, of new gloves being snapped on. But for a moment, Frankie heard nothing except this one infant struggle to breathe. "I'm so sorry, baby," Frankie said. The baby drew in an uneven breath and exhaled slowly, and then went still. Frankie held the dead baby, overwhelmed by this loss, unable to move, unable to stand. No one would ever know who this child was, or even that she had lived and died. How could this be done even in the name of war?
"McGrath, I need you."
It was Dr. Morse. Ignoring him and the melee of the OR, she carried the infant to the morgue, where body bags lay stacked along the walls. Private Juan Martinez, a kid from Chula Vista who'd been drafted right out of high school, stood in the center of the morgue. He looked as exhausted as she felt.
"Rough night," he said.
She glanced down at the baby in her arms. "And now this." Martinez stared down at the baby.
"Jesus,"
he said softly, moving closer. He placed a black-gloved hand on the baby's body, covering the entire ruined ribcage.
"He will hold you in heaven."
Frankie was surprised to hear that bit of faith from a man who stood in the morgue all day, cataloging the dead, zipping up body bags. Then again, maybe you couldn't do this job otherwise. Martinez found a cardboard box and an old t-shirt. Frankie wrapped the baby in the soft khaki cotton and laid her in the box. She and Martinez stood there for a moment, the box and the baby between them. Neither spoke. Then Frankie left the morgue. As she shut the door, she heard the incoming choppers and felt something ugly take root inside of her. A dark anger. She was so tired of pulling green canvas over young men's faces, and now this baby. With a sigh, she headed back to the OR, grabbed a gown, and went back to work.
"Get out of here, McGrath," Dr. Morse said at 0200. "You're dead on your feet."
"We all are," she said. The OR was so full of burn victims that many lay three to a bed.
Yeah, but you look it.
Har har, a beauty joke. Perfect. He touched her shoulder, gave it a squeeze.
Go. If you don't, I will.
Frankie pulled off her blue surgical cap.
Thanks, Doc. My tank really does feel empty.
Get some sleep.
She looked around.
After this?
He gave her a look of commiseration. They both knew sleep was unlikely. There wasn't enough pot or alcohol on site to make her forget that baby dying in her arms. She thanked Doc and headed for her hooch. As she passed the new admin building, she ducked in, found Talkback on the radio.
Hey, Talkback, could I make a Mars call? Short, I promise.
He glanced left to right, looking for a superior who might disagree. The military auxiliary radio system phones were not for personal use.
Short.
She settled into a chair and picked up the handset.
Call to Vung Tau, HAL 3. Lieutenant Commander Joseph Ryerson Walsh, over.
Frankie tapped her foot impatiently, listening to static.
Who is calling? Over.
Lieutenant McGrath, 71st EVAC, over.
Emergency, ma'am? Over.
Yes, emergency, over.
Hold, over.
Frankie knew she shouldn't be doing this, calling him and saying it was an emergency, but they hadn't seen each other in more than a month and she needed him.
Frankie?
Rye's voice broke through the static.
Are you okay? Over.
Hey,
she said, her voice quaking.
Over.
What happened? Over.
Napalm. Over.
In the staticky silence, she knew they were both seeing the suffering of tonight.
Sorry I woke you, I just needed to hear your voice. Over,
she said.
I get it, babe. I'm sorry.
Over.
I miss you. Over.
Hang tough. Over.
Copy that. Over and out.
She hung up.
Thanks, Talkback.
She headed back to her hooch. The park was empty now, but she knew that wouldn't last. When tonight's push was over, folks would need to unwind. A faint beat of music pulsed through the open door. She almost recognized the song, but not quite. Mostly she heard the beat of American music, the soundtrack of home. She took a quick shower, then passed a soldier tossing things into a burn barrel that gave off the stench of charred flesh and human excrement. In her hooch, she peeled out of her fatigues, shoved them in the laundry bag hanging off the end of her cot. Laundering them wouldn't remove the blood, but it would soften the smell. She climbed into bed. Knowing she wouldn't sleep, she picked up her latest letter to Ethel and started to add to it. Rough night in the OR. Could have used someone with your kick-ass skills, but Margie has really come into her own, and that young doc, Morse, is getting good. There was a baby tonight. Napalm. She put down her pen, unable to write about it. She set the letter aside. Did Ethel need to read this? Turning off the lights, she stretched out, closed her eyes. She was still awake at 0400 when Margie came home and climbed into bed. She was still awake at 0524, listening to her hooch mate snoring, when she heard the whine of a helicopter nearing the hospital. Only one. Releasing a breath, she closed her eyes again. Please, God, let me sleep. A knock at the door surprised her. She sat up. The door opened. Rye moved into the small hooch, seeming to take up a lot of space. Stepping carefully so as not to waken Margie, he moved to the cot, sat down, and took off his boots. Frankie still hadn't spoken. She was afraid that if she did, she'd cry. He took her in his arms and held her. They barely fit together on the narrow cot. She snuggled up against him, kissed his neck.
I got here as soon as I could,
he said. She started to answer, but before she could speak, she was asleep. For once, the 71st was quiet. On this hot, dry, early November day, not long after Nixon won the election back home, and 8 months into her second tour, Frankie sat in a beach chair in the park, wearing shorts and a t-shirt and her worn huarache sandals. A hot breeze ruffled the drying banana leaves. After a long, wet, muddy monsoon season, the dry air and dust were a welcome relief. At least she didn't smell like mildew anymore. She kept her boonie hat pulled low to shield her eyes from the sun and wore a pair of big round sunglasses. A warm tab sat on the ground beside her. Behind her, I heard it through the grapevine blasted through the speakers at the tiki bar. She could hear people talking, laughing, singing along. It had been a particularly tough week, but at this moment in the late afternoon, while a bright sun shone down on them without baking them into submission, the 71st wasn't a bad place to be. Men played volleyball on the flat red pad of dirt. The Red Cross donut dollies were handing out mail and snacks from a cart. Frankie had also brought some letters to reread while she ate the pretzel sticks Ethel had sent in her latest care package. Barb and Ethel had both continued to write and send goodies every month. Margie sat in a chair beside Frankie, her hair in pink curlers, reading Rosemary's Baby. Frankie took a drink of her warm tab, then leaned back and closed her eyes. "Ma'am," someone said a few moments later. Frankie sat up. The park was empty. No men playing volleyball, no donut dollies. Had she actually fallen asleep? The new radio operator, she couldn't remember the kid's name, stood there. "There's an emergency in the mess hall, ma'am. Dr. Morse needs you." Frankie got up and followed the kid to the mess hall. At the closed door, he stopped, allowed her to go in first. Frankie opened the door and stepped into the mess. A banner hung over the bulletin board wall. "Congrats, First Lieutenant McGrath." "Congratulations!" It took Frankie a second to process. No heart attack, no emergency. A party. For her. Major Goldstein from the 36th stepped forward, with Captain Miniver beside her. "This promotion is late in coming, but nothing happens on time in the Army," Major Goldstein said. "We all know that. Congratulations, Frankie. You've come a long way, baby." Captain Miniver added, "Thank you for staying. There are men back home because of it." "Toast! Toast!" someone yelled. Ryan Dardis, the new surgeon they called Hollywood because of his good looks, stepped forward with a bottle of gin.
"We know how much you love your gin, McGrath. What we wanted to make sure is that you know how much we dig you, too. Even though you can't dance for shit, and your dancing makes your singing look good."
He held up a bottle of gin, and there was a roar of approval. Someone cranked up the music. Behind her, the doors banged open. Frankie felt herself being picked up, spun around.
"Sorry I'm late, babe."
Rye grinned, tilted back his black seawolf's cap.
"Traffic was a bitch."
The music changed to Born to be Wild, and people started pushing chairs aside. Frankie grabbed Rye's hand and pulled him onto the makeshift dance floor.
"You sure you want to dance with me in public?"
he teased. "I'm the one with two left feet," she said, smiling up at him. Sometime later, Margie found them on the dance floor and hip-bumped Frankie. Her face was flushed and dewy from dancing.
"I'm going to bunk with Helen tonight," she said breathlessly. "Or maybe with Jeff. He's looking better every second."
"Thanks, Margie," Frankie said. Rye took Frankie by the hand and led her out of the party, which was in such full, chaotic swing that no one noticed them leave. They hadn't seen each other in almost a month.
"I really needed this," Frankie said, leaning against him as they walked through the compound.
He put an arm around her.
"I've missed you too. Another orphanage was bombed last week. St. Anne's in Saigon."
Frankie nodded.
"I heard rumors of something bad up near My Lai too," she said.
"There are a lot of bad stories coming through."
Outside her hooch, she turned to him, looked up into his eyes, saw his sadness. It was the same look she had seen in her own eyes. The last thing she wanted to talk about was the war.
"Love me," she whispered, pressing up onto her toes.
The kiss was everything. Coming home, taking flight, a dream for tomorrow. When he drew back, she saw something in his eyes that frightened her. Then he said,
"I'm afraid I'll love you till I die, Frankie."
Love. How long had she wanted to hear that word from him? It felt like forever, because time in Vietnam moved in strange ways, sometimes too fast, sometimes too slow.
"I love you too, Rai."
It wasn't until hours later, when they lay pressed together on her narrow cot, exhausted by lovemaking, that Frankie realized what he'd said and how he'd said it. "I'm afraid I'll love you till I die." And the promise planted a small and terrible seed in her heart. "I'm afraid till I die." They were the wrong words for wartime, a gauntlet thrown to an uncaring god. She wanted to have the moment to do over, to make him say, "I love you," in a different way. 18. On her last day in country, March 14th, 1969, Frankie woke up well before dawn, listening to Margie's quiet snores. She turned on the light beside her bed, reached past the hot plate, picked up the photograph of her and Finley at Disneyland, and stared down at it, thinking of their youth. "Hey, Finn, I'm going home." She'd joined the army to find her brother and found herself instead. In war, she'd found out who she really was and who she wanted to be, and as tired as she was of all the death and destruction, she was also more than a little afraid to go home. What would life look like stateside? She got out of her cot and pulled her footlocker out from underneath. Lifting the lid, she stared down at the belongings she'd be sending home, mementos she'd been given by soldiers, a leather and bead bracelet, a small gold elephant charm for luck, some silk she'd bought in Saigon, a Kelly clamp and some rubber tubing, the gifts for her friends and family, and her treasured Vietnam photographs, both those she'd taken and others she'd been given, like the one of her and Barb and Ethel, dancing in shorts and t-shirts at the O Club, the one Barb had left her of the three of them standing together, one of Jamie giving her a bright smile and a thumbs up in front of a deuce and a half, and another of her and Rye. There were at least a dozen photographs of her with soldiers who'd come through her OR, the lucky ones for whom she'd waved goodbye and posed for a picture. Back in the real world, the so-called summer of love had come and gone. In its wake, the protests were getting louder, longer, angrier. Even here, there was anger about the war. Soldiers had begun to draw peace symbols on their helmets in violation of army regulations. At 0600 hours, she packed up her duffel and travel bags and wrote Margie a goodbye note that said, in part, "I know you'll wish I'd wakened you for a goodbye. It won't be long before you'll know how hard it is. We are professionals at goodbye, and still it hurts. Stay tough. Thanks for sending my footlocker home for me." She dressed in her Class A's, complete with pantyhose and polished black pumps. She didn't have a full-length mirror, but she imagined she looked nothing like the wide-eyed girl who'd first landed in country 2 years ago. And her uniform smelled like mildew. When she opened her hooch door, she found Rye leaning against a pole, smoking a cigarette.
"Ready?"
he said, taking the duffel from her, swinging the big, awkward bag easily over his shoulder.
"Not really."
They walked through the surprisingly quiet camp, boarded the Huey, and lifted up into the sky. In Saigon, at the airport, she thanked the pilot, checked her duffel, and let Rye take her to the Freedom Bird that would take her home. A steady stream of soldiers walked past her on the tarmac at Tonsonute, climbed up the movable stairs, and ducked into the large Braniff jet. They were a quiet bunch. There was no joking or laughing. Not yet. Not while they were still in country.
27 days until you leave too, Frankie said, looking up at him. She had to raise her voice to be heard above the rumble of the engines. 27 days, an eternity in wartime.
No fear, McGrath.
A jeep rolled past them, full of soldiers with guns looking for snipers. More gunfire nearby. Pop, pop, pop. In the distance, a loud explosion. Something burst into flames on one of the runways. Rai stared down at her.
Frankie, I don't know how to tell you. I won't.
I know, she said, touching his rough, unshaven face. I love you too.
He let out a breath, gazed down at her.
God, I'll miss you.
He pulled her into a tight embrace, held her hard against him, and kissed her goodbye. She clung to him for as long as she dared, and then slowly pulled away. Neither said goodbye. The word carried more than a hint of bad luck. She straightened her shoulders and forced herself to walk away from him. At the top of the steps, she finally turned back. Alone, he stood tall and straight in his worn fatigues, with a brimmed seawolf's cap pulled down low on his forehead. From here, he looked solid and steady, the perfect sailor, but she saw the clenched line of his jaw. He raised a single hand, fingers splayed, and held it there, then pressed it to his heart. Frankie nodded, waved back one last time, and entered the jet. Most of the seats were already filled with men who kept glancing back at the door as if Charlie might come breaking through any second, rifles drawn. They all knew they weren't safe in the air until they were out of Vietnamese airspace. Frankie found a seat on the starboard side, put her travel bag in the overhead bin, and sat at the window, staring out at Rai. She pressed her hand to the glass. She heard the aircraft door close, clank shut. Moments later, the jet rolled down the runway, bumping over the bomb-pocked ground, and slowly lifted off. Frankie stared out the window, saw clouds as they flew over the war-torn land toward the safety of home. The passengers applauded. Someone shouted, "We're out of there!" Frankie was surprised to feel a version of sorrow. As bad as it had been in Nam, as frightened and angry and betrayed as she'd often felt by her government and the war, she'd also felt alive, competent and important, a woman who made a difference in the world. This place would forever hold a piece of her heart. Here, she had found her place in the world, and she was afraid that home was no longer the place she wanted it to be. 34 hours later, after a 6-hour layover at Travis Air Force Base in Northern California, Frankie stared out the oval window at the busy runways of Los Angeles International Airport. Full daylight, a sun so bright it hurt one's eyes, a blue and cloudless sky. California, the Golden State, home. She had intended to call her parents from Travis, but when she'd finally made it to her turn in the payphone line, she had turned away. She didn't really know why. The gate area at LAX was crowded. She saw military personnel sleeping on benches, sprawled on the dirty floor, using their duffel bags as pillows, passing time on their way home. It didn't seem right. Men who'd been shot at, and in some cases been patched up and sent back into harm's way, sleeping on the floor between flights. The military paid your way to a base airport. Once there, you had to buy your own ticket home. A real thank you for serving your country. As she neared baggage claim, she saw a group of protesters holding signs. End the war before it ends you. Drop acid, not bombs. Get out of Vietnam now. Bombing for peace is like screwing for virginity. They saw her, coming their way in her skirted army uniform, and thrust their signs at her, as if to convince her. Someone spat at her. "Nazi bitch!" one of the protesters yelled. Frankie stumbled to a halt in shock. "What the—" A pair of Marines appeared and flanked Frankie, one on each side of her.
"Don't listen to those assholes," one of them said.
Bookending her, they made their way to the carousel.
"We got nothing to be ashamed of."
Frankie didn't understand. Why would someone spit at her?
"Go back to Vietnam," someone yelled. "We don't want you baby killers here."
Baby killers? Frankie's duffel bag thumped onto the carousel. She started to reach for it, but one of the Marines beat her to it.
"I'll get that for you, Lieutenant."
"Let the bitch get her own bag," someone yelled.
Others laughed. "Thank you," Frankie said to the Marine. I mean, I heard about the protests, but this? She looked at the people crowded around the carousel, men in suits and women in dresses who'd said nothing to help her. Did they think it was okay to spit at an army nurse coming home from war? She expected it from hippies and protesters, but from ordinary people?
Ain't no World War II victory parade, one of the Marines said. Guess losing a war isn't something people cheer for, said the other.
Frankie looked at the two men, saw the ghosts that lived behind their eyes, the ghosts that lived in her, too. We're home, she said, needing to believe that was what mattered. She saw that they needed to believe it, too. Outside, she thanked the Marines for their help and looked for a cab. Alone out here, she saw the way people stared at her. First, there was a widening of the eyes, surprise at seeing a woman in uniform, and then the narrowing of mistrust or outright disgust. A few looked right through her as if she weren't there. She considered changing her clothes, but decided against it. Screw them. She wasn't going to let them shame her. At the curb, she put out one arm to hail a cab. The nearest yellow taxi veered out of the middle lane, headed toward her, and slowed. She stepped off the curb, and the cabbie yelled something and flipped her the bird and sped away, stopping not far away for a man in a suit. One after another, taxis slowed for her just enough to get her hopes up and then sped away. Finally, she gave up, bought a bus ticket, and ignored the veiled looks thrown her way as she lugged her heavy bags onto the bus. What was wrong with the world? It took 4 hours and 3 bus changes for her to reach Coronado Island. By then, she had been spat on 4 times, flipped off more times than she could count, and become used to, or at least immune to, the way people looked at her. No one had offered to help her carry her heavy duffel bag. At the ferry terminal on Coronado, she was finally able to hail a cab. A dour-looking driver didn't make eye contact, but picked her up and stopped outside the gate at her house, for which she was extremely grateful. She hauled her heavy duffel out of the vehicle and dropped it on the sidewalk and stood there, soaking in the sense of coming home. The air smelled of the sea, of lemons and oranges, of her childhood. She looked over at the mighty Pacific Ocean. She could hear the surf from here. The familiar sound soothed her anxiety. A group of kids on bicycles, with playing cards in the spokes, sped past her, laughing. She couldn't help thinking of Finley, of the forts they'd once built among the eucalyptus, of the sand castles they'd built, of the hours spent on bicycles. Come nightfall, the porch lights would start coming on up and down the street, beacons used by mothers to guide their children home for dinner. A pair of Navy jets screamed overhead. She couldn't help wondering if they were piloted by men who would soon be flying combat missions on the other side of the world. She opened the gate and stared at the home she'd grown up in, feeling a rush of emotion. She couldn't wait to be welcomed home at last, to be admired for her service instead of reviled. How often had she dreamed of this moment, of safety and love and comfort, of hot baths and fresh coffee and long, slow walks along the beach without an armed guard standing by. She stepped into the beautifully manicured backyard, drinking it all in, the whispering of the oak leaves, the scent of chlorine and ripening lemons, the soft clatter of her mother's wind chimes. Struggling with her heavy duffel and her overnight bag, she walked around the pool and up to the glass-paned doors. Opening them, she stepped back in time. For a second, she was a girl again, following her wild brother wherever he went. Home. She dropped her duffel bag on the polished hardwood floor.
Hey, you guys,
she said, at the same time her father came around the corner, dressed in a lime green turtleneck with checkered slacks, holding a folded newspaper. His hair was a little longer, as were his sideburns, which held a few strands of gray. At the sight of her, he stopped, frowned briefly.
Frankie, did we know you were coming home?
She couldn't hold back a smile.
I wanted to surprise you.
He moved forward woodenly, confusion on his face. She knew her father didn't like surprises. He liked to always be in control. He gave her a brief, hard hug. He released her so quickly that Frankie stumbled back.
I should have called, she said.
No, he said, shook his head. Of course not. We're glad you're home.
Frankie realized suddenly what she looked like after so many hours of travel. Hair a mess, poorly cut, no makeup on, uniform wrinkled. No wonder her dad was frowning. She reached into her purse and pulled out her favorite picture of her and Ethel and Barb, arms around each other, standing in front of the O Club.
I brought this one just for you.
He glanced at the photograph.
Oh.
For the Heroes Wall, she said.
Mom came around the corner, dressed in bright red ankle pants and a white top, her hair covered by a silk scarf.
Frances!
She rushed forward and pulled Frankie into a fierce hug.
My girl,
she said, easing back, touching Frankie's face.
Why didn't you call?
She wanted to surprise us,
Dad said.
Apparently it wasn't enough of a surprise when she joined the army. I'm sorry, but I have a meeting.
Frankie watched her father leave the house, heard the door shut behind him. It unsettled her, his leaving so abruptly.
Don't take it to heart, Mom said lightly. Ever since Finley's passing and your leaving, he isn't himself.
Oh, Frankie said. Had her mother just equated her war service to her brother's death?
Frances, I...
Mom's hand slid down Frankie's arm, as if maybe she couldn't quite let her daughter go, couldn't quite believe that she was here again.
I've missed you so.
Me too, Frankie said.
You must be exhausted, Mom said.
I am.
Why don't you take a nice hot bath and perhaps a nap?
Frankie nodded, confused. She felt battered by hours of travel and the way she'd been treated by strangers, and now by her parents. What was wrong? She left her mother in the living room and headed for her childhood bedroom with its canopy bed and pink ruffles. Most kids had posters in their rooms, but Mom hadn't allowed tacks to be stuck into her expensive wallpaper, so Frankie had framed art on her walls. A row of old stuffed animals sat along the top of her bookshelf. A pink ballerina jewelry box on the bedside table held junior and high school trinkets, probably a stack of senior pictures and prom memorabilia. You knew what was expected of a girl who slept in a room like this. Only Frankie wasn't that girl anymore. At the end of the bed stood a hope chest, which was filled with perfectly folded and pressed tablecloths and Italian linens and embroidered sheets. Mom had started filling this chest when Frankie was 8 years old. Every birthday and Christmas, Frankie had received something for her hope chest. The message then and now was clear. Marriage made a woman whole and happy. Again, it was for the girl who'd left for Vietnam, not for the woman who'd come home. Whoever that woman turned out to be. Frankie peeled out of her uniform and left it in a heap on the floor. Crawling between the soft, lavender-scented sheets, she lay her head on the silk-cased pillow. She shouldn't have surprised her parents. She'd caught them off guard. Tomorrow would be better.
19. The smell of burning flesh. Someone is screaming. I run forward, crying for help, trying to see through the smoke. There's a baby in my arms, burning. Her skin blackens and falls away. I am holding a pile of bones. Choppers overhead, incoming. A scream. Mine? The red alert siren blares. Something explodes near my head. I throw myself out of my cot, hit the floor, crawl for my flak jacket and helmet.
Quiet. Frankie came out of the nightmare slowly, realized she was on the floor in her bedroom. Curling into a ball on the rug, she tried to go back to sleep. The next time Frankie awoke, it was 21:15 hours and the house was dark. She heard the faint ticking of her bedside clock. She had no idea how long she'd slept. A day? Two? She got dressed and wandered through the house. At her father's office, she stared at the pictures on the hero's wall, saw Finley smiling at her on his way to war. Another world. Now, no one welcomed you home, let alone celebrated your leaving. Suddenly, she felt suffocated by the scent of lemon furniture polish and expectation. She'd been raised to be a lady, always serene and calm, smiling. But that world and those lessons felt far, far away. Outside, a full moon shone down on the waves. She felt drawn to the beach, as always, the stretch of sand that had been her playground as a child. "Hey, Finn," she said, sitting close to the waterline. An occasional spray of water hit her cheek, felt like tears. She closed her eyes. "Just breathe, McGrath." Gradually, the tightening in her chest eased. Much later, she went back to her frilly pink room and climbed into bed. In the glow of her bedside lamp, she opened her nightstand drawer and pulled out a piece of stationery with her full name written in elegant script across the top.
"March 17th. Dear Barb, I'm home. No one told me how tough it was, this re-entry. Why didn't you warn me? People spat at me at the airport, called me a baby killer. What the hell? My parents haven't even asked about Vietnam. Mom acts as if I am home from band camp, and my dad has barely said a word to me. Honest to God. It's weird. Tell me I'll be okay, will you? And how about you? I've been thinking about you, sending good thoughts to you about your brother. Grief sucks. Being home makes me miss Finn all over again. It's like staring down at a puzzle with one piece missing. It ruins the whole thing. Now I'm back to bed. I'm more than tired. Too many hours of travel and despair and jet lag, I guess. Love you, sis. Stay cool. F." Then she stripped down to her bra and underwear and climbed back into bed. "Wake up, Francis." Frankie opened her eyes slowly, feeling grit on her eyeballs. She sat up, feeling bruised. Once again, she was on the floor. "I'll meet you in the kitchen," Mom said, looking worriedly at Frankie before she turned and walked away.
"Okay,"
Frankie said, tasting something foul in her mouth. When had she last brushed her teeth? She limped to her closet. How had she twisted her ankle, pushed past her old pogo stick, and shoved aside a hula hoop, and then slipped into her pink chenille robe and left the bedroom? Why was everything about her past so damned pink? "Finally," Mom said from the kitchen table, smiling. Frankie went to the coffee pot, poured herself a cup, and sat down at the table across from her mother.
"Where's Dad?"
"You look awful, Francis."
"I'm having nightmares."
"I've made reservations for lunch at the club. I thought it would feel good to get back to real life. Just us girls." Frankie sipped her coffee, savoring the bitter, rich taste of it. Nightmare images clung like cobwebs to her mind.
"Is that what you think the club is? Real life?"
Mom frowned. "What's wrong with you?"
"People spat at me at the airport," Frankie said, surprised at the way her voice broke. "Called me a baby killer."
Mom's mouth opened in surprise, then slowly closed. "I've called Paul and made you an appointment for this morning. A nice new haircut always brightens my mood."
"Sure, Mom. I know how much appearances matter to you. Where's Dad?" she asked again.
"I bought you some new clothes. They're in your closet."
"Mom, you didn't answer me about Dad."
"Let me catch my breath, Francis, will you? A little warning that you were coming home would have helped. You've known the date for a year, Mom. You still should have called. Go take a shower and get dressed. You know I abhor being late."
Nodding, Frankie rose, took her coffee with her, and walked back to her bedroom. There, she found the new clothes that Mom had bought. bell-bottom pants and plaid separates and tunic tops, all a size too big. None of it felt right, so she put on the red dress she'd bought on Kauai and pantyhose and sandals. So what if it was March and she was dressed for summer? The dress comforted her, reminded her that Rai was coming home to her in 23 days. She found her mother waiting impatiently at the front door. At Frankie's appearance, one plucked eyebrow arched. As Frankie neared, Mom's nostrils flared.
Yeah, the dress smells mildewed, I know.
Mom managed a smile. Let's go. 15 minutes later, she and her mother were at the Island Beauty Salon, being fussed over by Paul.
Who has been cutting your hair, darling? He said.
Me, Frankie said. Or a girlfriend.
With a machete, it looks like.
Frankie smiled. Pretty much. I just got home from Vietnam.
The distaste on Paul's face was unmistakable. He actually took a step back.
I think I can pull off a chin-length sideswept bob. Okay?
That look from him hurt, but she should have been ready for it.
Sure, whatever.
Paul set to work, washing, combing, cutting, styling. When he began to tease the back of her hair, Frankie stopped him, said sharply,
None of that girly shit for me, Paul.
She heard her mother's sharp intake of breath.
Language, Francis. You're not a longshoreman.
When Paul finished, Frankie stood up and looked at herself in the mirror. He'd made her black hair glossy again, teased it up in back, and cut it in a precise line along her jaw. Long bangs swept to one side.
It's nice, she said. Thanks.
He nodded crisply and walked away. At the Coronado Golf and Tennis Club, a uniformed black attendant met the Cadillac and opened Frankie's door. She stepped out, felt a strange sensation of collision. How could this cool, white, moneyed world exist in a bubble while in Vietnam a war was raging and here at home people were protesting the violence and fighting for fundamental civil rights? The main clubhouse was designed like an old-fashioned living room centered around a stone fireplace. Here and there, groups of men were seated, drinking and smoking. Cocktail lunches were the norm here for the working men. A group of women wreathed in cigarette smoke played bridge in a room off to the right. The waitress led them to her parents' favorite table, which overlooked the pool. White tablecloths, silver flatware, bone china plates, and a centerpiece of fragrant flowers. Frankie sat down.
How lovely to be out with my girl for lunch, Mom said, taking out her silver cigarette case, extracting a slim cigarette, lighting it up.
When the waitress appeared, Mom ordered 2 Bloody Marys.
Kind of early, isn't it, Mom?
You too, Francis.
What do you mean?
Your father keeps remarking upon my drinking. When he's home, that is.
Before Frankie could formulate a rejoinder, a man appeared at their table. An elderly man with walrus jowls and a gray military flat top, wearing a brown suit with a thin tie.
Bet, he said, smiling jovially. How nice to see you out and about. My Millicent says you are favored to win the tournament again this year.
Mom smiled.
Millicent is too kind. Francis, you remember Dr. Brenner?
This can't be Francis, can it? Home from Florence already.
Florence? Frankie was about to say more when she heard a loud crash.
Incoming. She dove for the floor. Frankie? Frankie?
What the hell? The world righted. She wasn't in Nam. She was in the country club dining room, sprawled on the floor beside the table like a fool. Not far away, a waitress was kneeling on the floor picking up broken glass. Dr. Brenner took hold of her hand and helped her to her feet.
Frankie, Mom said, frowning. Who falls out of a chair?
Frankie didn't know what had just happened. The memory had felt so real.
I don't...
She felt clammy, shaky. She pushed her hair out of her face, felt the sweat on her forehead. It took effort to smile.
I'm sorry. I just got home from Vietnam and...
And what? Dr. Brenner let go of her hand.
There are no women in Vietnam, dear.
There are, sir. I did 2 tours.
Her father said you were studying abroad.
What? Frankie turned to her mother. Are you fucking kidding me? Dr. Brenner left like a shot at the curse word. Mom looked around to see if they were being observed.
Sit down, Francis. You lied about where I was? Your father thought. He was ashamed of me? Ashamed of my service after all those stories, all that hero talk? Sit down, Francis. You're making a scene. Am I embarrassing you? She said. And you think this is a scene? No, Mom. A scene is when a soldier comes in off the battlefield holding his own foot. It's when... Francis Grace!
Tears scalded Frankie's eyes. She ran out of the club, heard the whispers that would grow into rumors about the McGrath girl, and she would have laughed if it didn't hurt so much. Down the street, a stitch burning in her side, she hailed a cab. It was easy now, just a hand in the air, no uniform to make people hate her. The taxi pulled up alongside her. The driver rolled down the window.
Where to?
Where to? It felt as if there were nothing left for her here, in this place she'd always loved. But where else? She said,
Ocean Boulevard,
with a sigh, and wiped her eyes. She had nowhere else to go. Once there, she pulled out a piece of the blue stationery. In a hand that wouldn't stop shaking, she wrote to Rye, tried to ease her hurt by sharing it.
March 22nd, 1969. My love, I miss you so much I can't stand it. I'm counting the days until your return. Things at home are terrible. I don't know what to do. My parents lied about my service in Vietnam. That's how ashamed they are of me. It makes me mad in a way I've never felt before. Furious. Pissed off. Today I caused a scene at the country club. I can't quite control this new fury that is eating me up. Maybe I just need sleep. Everything is so weird and upside down. I haven't even told my parents about you. I'm not sure they'd care. I can't wait for you to come home. I love you. F.
Sometime later, Frankie woke up sprawled on her bedroom floor with a pounding headache and a sore throat, probably because she had screamed in her sleep. She got to her feet, held herself together by sheer force of will. Nightmares had left her shaken, and she was still angry at her parents' betrayal. The room was dark, no lights on to banish the night. How long had she slept? In the hallway, decorated in rich wood and gleaming brass, she smelled cigarette smoke, lemon furniture polish, and a hint of Shalimar perfume. Mom was in the living room, still dressed for the club, seated in a chair by the cold fireplace, sipping a martini, reading a Life magazine. A pair of table lamps illuminated the room. A fire in the fireplace sent out waves of heat. Dad stood by the fire, dressed in a suit and tie, holding a drink and a lit cigarette. At the sight of Frankie in her robe, he frowned. No doubt she was not looking her best.
Yeah, it's me, Dad. Back from studying abroad in Florence. The food wasn't nearly as good as I expected, Frankie said, unable to keep the hurt out of her voice.
No one likes a smart aleck, Frankie, he said.
She went to the bar, poured herself a large gin on the rocks, and took a seat by her mother. The tension in the room felt heavy. She saw the wary, worried look in her mother's eyes. Frankie reached over for one of her mother's cigarettes and lit up.
When did you start to smoke? Mom asked.
I think it was after a red alert.
At her mother's blank look, she added, Rocket attack on the hospital. The explosions were deafening, terrifying. Or maybe after a push in the hospital where men came in blown to shit. Who knows? One minute I wasn't a smoker, the next minute I was. It helped with the shaking in my hands.
I see, her mother said tightly.
No, you don't, Frankie said. Desperate suddenly to explain. If they would just listen, everything might fall into place. At the 36th, that's the evac hospital where I was assigned, my first shift in country was a mass casualty, and shit was I a disaster,
Frankie said. They were staring at her, listening. Thank God.
This soldier came in on a litter, all blown to shit. He'd stepped on a bouncing Betty and his legs were gone, just gone. I had no...
Enough!
Dad slammed down his drink on the bar. He'd used such force the glass could have cracked.
No one wants to hear these stories, Frankie. Sweet God. Legs blown off.
And the language, Mom said. Cursing like a sailor. I couldn't believe the language you used at the club, and in front of Dr. Brenner. I had to call Millicent and apologize on your behalf.
Apologize on my behalf? Frankie said. How can you not care about my war experience?
It's over, Francis, Mom said smoothly.
Calm down, Frankie. But she couldn't do it. Her heart was pounding, and she felt a surge of fury so overwhelming she wanted to hit something. For a moment, she held back, but the effort it took felt toxic, as if the stories she wanted to share might turn to poison inside of her. She couldn't be here, pretending nothing had changed, that she'd been in Florence for 2 years instead of holding men's body parts together in her bare hands. She felt choked by her need to say, I was there, and this is how it was, for them to welcome her home and say they were proud of her. Frankie stood up abruptly. I can't believe you're ashamed of me.
I have no idea who you are anymore,
Dad said.
You don't want to know, Frankie said. You think it means nothing when a woman, a nurse, goes to war. You think it's glorious that your son goes to war and embarrassing when your daughter does.
Her mother stood up, holding a now empty martini glass, a little unsteady on her feet, tears in her eyes.
Francis, please, she said.
Connor, you both shut up and drink,
Dad said in almost a snarl. Frankie saw how her mother sagged at that. Had it always been like this? Had Mom always been a shadow woman held together by vodka and hairspray? Had her dad always been this angry man who thought he had the right to dictate every action and emotion in this house? Or had it been losing Finley that ruined them? Frankie didn't know. She hadn't lived with them these past 2 years, and truthfully, she'd grieved alone, and then she'd gone to Vietnam and learned a whole new kind of loss. Frankie had to get out of here before she said something terrible. She left them standing there, staring at her as if she were an intruder, and walked out of the house. She slammed the door shut behind her. It wasn't like her, that burst of fury and the wanting to display it, but she couldn't stop it. Out on the beach, with night darkening around her, she dropped to her knees, wanting to be calmed by the sound of the surf. But it made her think of Vietnam, of Finley and Jamie and the Fallen. She screamed until she was hoarse, and the anger inside of her grew.
March 24th, 1969. Dear Rye, this time at home has been a shit show. Even as I write those words, I think that isn't me, but it is me now. I'm angry all of the time, and hurt. My parents hardly speak to me and rarely to each other. They don't want to hear anything about Vietnam. That's not even the worst of it. I have these terrible nightmares of the war. I wake up feeling like I've been beaten up. It's because you're not in bed with me. I could sleep in your arms. Dreaming of it, of you coming back, is holding me together. I'm counting the days until you are here, with me. I think of us. You, a house, in the country, maybe. I want to have horses, a dog, a garden. Things aren't as easy as I thought coming home. But it doesn't matter. All that matters is us. I love you. F.
On a cool evening, 2 weeks after her homecoming, Frankie sat in a chair on the patio, her feet tucked up underneath her, a blanket wrapped around her shoulders. In her tattered army green t-shirt and baggy shorts, she smelled of mildew and mold and dust, but it was vaguely comforting. She sipped an ice-cold martini and glanced idly around. She was home, in her own backyard, where soon the jacaranda tree would burst into full purple bloom and the gardeners would spend hours raking up the fallen flowers. It was like a time capsule, this yard, where nothing ever changed. The outside world could be breaking apart, but inside these walls, all was calm, quiet, cocktails. Maybe that was why people built walls, to look away, to ignore anything they didn't want to see. In the last few days, the family had fallen into an uneasy détente in which no one talked about the war. Frankie hated every moment of it, felt stripped bare by her parents' shame, but it wouldn't be for much longer. She just had to make it until Rye came home. She hadn't told them about Rye or their love affair. She hadn't talked to them about anything, really. Just the weather and food and the garden. Neutral topics all. It was the only way to hold herself together in their presence.
"I'll call it the Shores, I think,"
Dad said, exhaling smoke as he poured himself a Manhattan.
"Or maybe the Cliffs."
Frankie listened to her dad's business talk and pretended to be interested. She was trying her best to be the girl they'd raised, the girl they expected. She didn't fidget, didn't say much, never mentioned the war, played nice. They didn't seem bothered in the least by her silence. It felt vaguely dangerous, this enforced calm, as if each word she swallowed contained a venom that might someday kill her. She focused on her martini, her second, thinking she would have killed for this ice-cold drink in country. Dad went to the stereo system, changed albums, put on the Beach Boys. California Girls started playing. "Turn that shit off," Frankie snapped. Both of her parents stopped what they were doing to stare at her.
"Who do you think you are?"
Dad said. Frankie stood up abruptly. She almost screamed, "Look at me!" to him. "See me!" "I'm right here, Dad," she said, her voice shaking. "Your daughter? Home from war?" He turned back to the stereo, busied himself with the stacks of records. Frankie felt fury building again, filling her up, stretching her out of shape. She went to the bar, grabbed a bottle of gin, and walked back to her bedroom, slamming the door behind her.
St. Elizabeth's Orphanage. I'm kneeling on the cold stone floor, holding Mai in my arms, stroking the child's soft hair. I hear the whir of incoming helicopters from far away, the pop-pop-pop of gunfire. A bomb rips into the stone walls, sends stone flying in a dozen directions. I hear children screaming. Another bomb. I look down. Mai is melting in my arms, fire everywhere.
Frankie came awake with a scream, her heart pounding. She was drenched in sweat. She stumbled out of her room into the dark, quiet house.
0523 hours.
She went to the kitchen phone, picked it up, and dialed Barb's number. No doubt there would be hell to pay when the bill came in. Long-distance calls were so expensive, but she needed to talk to her best friend. Barb answered on the second ring.
"Hello?"
"Hey,"
Frankie said quietly. Holding the receiver to her ear, she slid down the kitchen wall and sat on the linoleum floor.
"I just thought I'd check in on you, see how you're holding up. How's your mom?"
"Frankie," Barb said. "How are you?"
"We don't have to talk about me. I know how much you miss your brother."
"Frankie," Barb said. "Are you okay?" Frankie shook her head, whispered,
"No, not okay."
"I got your letter. Your folks really told people you were studying abroad? That is brutal."
"Yeah."
Frankie let out a breath.
"That's rough, man," Barb said.
"How was it when you came home? Bad?"
"Yeah, but my mama's block is full of vets coming home. Ain't no lying about it. All I know is you gotta push through, keep on going. Soldier on. It'll all settle out."
Frankie heard the hope in those words.
"Rye's home soon, so there's that. I swear if he asks me to move in with him, I'm saying yes."
Barb laughed.
"You? Miss I need a ring first?"
"That's not me anymore," Frankie said.
"Yeah, Life is short, and don't we know it. You having a party for him when he gets back? Maybe I could get Ethel to road trip to La La Land.
I hadn't thought about a party.
You and I know how hard it is to come back. A little cake helps everything.
Frankie thought about it. A party.
His dad lives up in Compton. Maybe we could plan something together.
That's the spirit.
Thanks, Barb. I knew you'd haul me out of this funk I'm in.
What are girlfriends for?
They talked for a few more minutes, and by the time she hung up, Frankie had a plan. It might be a bad idea, or a great idea. She wasn't sure. All she knew was that once Barb had suggested the idea of a party for Rye, Frankie was on a mission. So she dressed in the new clothes her mother had purchased for her, baggy bell-bottom jeans and a tunic top with a hip belt, and called information to get an address for Stanley and Moe's Auto Repair in Compton. By 0900 hours, without a word to her parents, she was dressed, with makeup on, and pulling out of the gated yard in the baby blue Volkswagen Bug that had been her 16th birthday present. On the ferry, she rolled down her window, let the air wash across her face. She heard the roar of heavy equipment and the clang of jackhammers being used to construct the bridge from San Diego to Coronado, an improvement her father had fought tirelessly for. She felt hopeful for the first time in days, directed. She was, in the words of her favorite poem, Desiderata, advancing confidently in the direction of her dreams. On the mainland, she cranked up the radio, heard Wolfman Jack's famous howl, and sang along with the music. Cream, Country Joe and the Fish, the Beatles, the music of Vietnam. In Compton, she slowed down. It had been years since the Watts riots, but the remnant of that time of trouble was still visible in boarded-up windows, broken porches, and graffiti. Spray-painted black fists emblazoned the walls of empty storefronts and closed-up restaurants. The poverty of the neighborhood was obvious. She passed a junkyard where heaps of metal and broken-down cars huddled behind chain-link fencing. A growling dog followed her moving car from one end of the fence to the other, straining at the end of big linked chain. Abandoned cars sat on untended lots, their tires missing, hubcaps gone, windshields cracked. Many of the houses were dilapidated, in need of paint. She saw groups of black men ambling down the street, dressed in black, wearing black berets. Stanley and Moe's Auto Repair was housed in a 1940s-era gas station with a large garage beside it. Out of business had been spray-painted in red across the garage doors. Crushed beer cans littered the yard. A trash can erupted with garbage. A trio of young black men walked past the garage. One of them saw Frankie and stopped to stare for a moment, then walked quickly to catch up with his friends. She pulled into the empty parking area and stepped out of the car. Somewhere close by, a dog started barking. A car backfired, sounded like gunfire. Calm down, Frankie. Breathe. It was just a car, not a mortar attack. She walked up to the shop's office, which looked abandoned. There was chicken wire and plywood over every window, and someone had painted Panther Power beneath one of them. The words were smeared, as if someone had tried to wash them away and given up. She knocked on the door.
"Go away!"
someone yelled from inside. Frankie opened the front door and was assailed by the odor of stale beer and cigarette smoke. "Hello?" She pushed the door open all the way and stepped over the threshold. It took her eyes a moment to adjust to the gloom inside. A single lamp sat on a metal filing cabinet, which was covered with stacks of paper. Old calendars covered one wall, the pin-up kind from another era, Betty Grable, Rita Hayworth. A grizzled man sat hunched in a wheeled office chair, staring at a rabbit-eared TV on another filing cabinet. As the World Turns was on.
"We're closed,"
he said harshly, without even looking at her.
"Been closed since the riots, but I ain't damn leaving. They won't run me out."
"Mr. Walsh?"
"Who wants to know?"
the man said, taking the cigarette from his mouth. He turned slowly,
saw her, and frowned.
Girlie, you are in the wrong part of town.
Frankie moved forward slowly. She saw the resemblance of Rye to his father. It was as if Rye's handsome face had been layered in fleshy gray modeling clay and left out in the sun to dry. The older man had cheeks that sagged into jowls and a bulbous nose. Thick brown eyebrows contrasted sharply with his colorless face and graying blonde hair. He had a mustache that was badly in need of tending. Gnarled hands curled around his drink glass. He wore a gray mechanics jumpsuit that read Stan on the pocket. Frankie saw the reality of Rye's childhood before her. No wonder he'd felt uncomfortable in the McGrath home at Finley's going-away party. No wonder he'd joined the military and dreamed of flying faster than the speed of sound. It made her even more determined to show him her love with a welcome home party.
I wanted to talk about throwing Rye a coming home party.
I know who you are, Missy. And there ain't gonna be a damned party for my son. You should know that.
Are you one of those people who are ashamed of the men and women in Vietnam?
He snorted.
Women in Vietnam. You on drugs?
Mr. Walsh, I want you to know...
Let me stop you right there.
He headed to the metal desk beneath the boarded-up window, which was covered with papers and ashtrays and dirty dishes. He rifled through a pile of envelopes and magazines and plucked out a piece of paper.
Here,
he said, handing her a telegram.
3 days ago, two assholes in uniform showed up here to tell me my kid was dead. Shot down. Some place like Ankle, Anki, who the hell knows?
Frankie stared down at the telegram. We regret to inform you, Lieutenant Commander Joseph Ryerson Walsh has been killed in action.
Remains ain't recoverable, the shithead said. He certainly won't need no welcome home party.
Mr. Walsh said. Frankie couldn't draw a breath.
It can't be true.
It is.
But...
Go on, Missy. Nothing for you here.
She turned away, stumbled out of the dirty office, and made it to the bug and collapsed inside. The telegram shook in her hand.
We regret to inform you.
Rye. She thought of him carrying her to her hooch the night he'd shown up in her OR worrying about her, their first kiss. That night on the beach on Kauai where he'd shown her what love felt like. I'm afraid I'll love you till I die. Rye. Her love. Gone. Frankie didn't remember driving home. When she pulled into her parents' driveway and parked, she looked up through her tears and was vaguely surprised to see where she was. She got out of the car, forgot to close the door or take her keys. She walked into the house and went directly to her bedroom. Music followed her. Pat Boone, her mom's favorite singer, tried to soothe and romance with his voice, but she barely heard it. It had been only a few hours since she'd heard those words, killed in action. But already it felt like a lifetime of sorrow, interminable. She climbed into bed, shoes and all. She leaned back into the stacks of pillows against her headboard and stared up at the frilly pink canopy. Grief blunted the world, put a thick, cottony veil between Frankie and everything else. She was so numb, it took a moment to realize that someone was knocking on her bedroom door. Go away, she said. The door opened. Her mother stood there, smiling uncertainly. It was how they looked at each other these days, but Frankie didn't care about that either.
There you are!
Frankie heard her own scream and knew it was a mistake, but she couldn't stop herself. She went from screaming in anger to sobbing in the time it took for her mother to get to the bed. Frankie rolled away, tucked her legs up into the fetal position. Mom edged up onto the bed beside her, stroked her hair. For a long time, she didn't say anything, just let Frankie cry. Finally, Frankie rolled into her mother's embrace instead of away from it.
What is it? Mom asked.
I fell in love in Vietnam.
Frankie drew in a shuddering breath.
He was shot down, killed in action.
She looked at her mother.
How could I not have known?
You never said anything about a man over there. Mom sighed heavily. Oh, Francis.
You didn't want to hear anything about the war.
Frankie waited for words of wisdom, for something, anything, to remind her that she still had a reason for living. Mom said nothing, just stroked her hair and held her close. Frankie felt her heartbeat slow, felt vaguely that it might be physically breaking down and would be unable to beat in a world without Rye, in this body of hers that felt suddenly foreign. Footsteps coming down the hall. Her father appeared in the open doorway, a briefcase in one hand, a handful of mail in the other. A friend of hers was shot down, Mom said.
Oh,
Dad said. He turned around and walked away, closing the door behind him. Frankie curled into her mother's arms and cried.
They're shooting at us. Pop, pop, pop. A spark of light hits the Huey broadside. The gunner shoots back. The chopper veers sharply to the left, then up to the right, does almost a pirouette. Another shot, sparks. The rat-a-tat-tat of the gunner shooting back, and then a loud crack of an explosion. The tail of the helicopter bends, breaks, falls to the jungle. Another explosion. This one is the fuel tank. The chopper bursts into a ball of flame and smoke and crashes to the ground. A thick black column of smoke and flames shoots up from the jungle. The trees catch fire. Frankie woke up, still in the throes of the nightmare, thinking that she was in Vietnam again, that she'd seen Rye get shot down. The world righted itself slowly. She was in her bedroom, with the frilly pink tulle canopy overhead and the ballerina jewelry box on her nightstand. Last night had been brutal, consecutive nightmares. She had a vague memory of wandering through the dark house, smoking, afraid to sleep. Feeling numb, her body heavy, her heart heavier, she stood. But once she was up, she didn't know what to do. She just stood there. There was a knock at her door. Frankie sighed. It had been only 2 days in a world without Rye. 48 hours of this grief, and already she couldn't stand being in this house. She hated the way her mom watched her, with sad, wary eyes, as if she were afraid Frankie might run out into traffic at any moment. Mom opened the door. She was dressed in a lavender silk peignoir with pearl buttons and pom-pommed white slippers. A white turban covered her hair. Frankie stared at her through bleary, bloodshot eyes.
How do I stop loving him?
You don't. You endure. You go on. I won't insult you by mentioning the supposed healing properties of time, but it will get better. Mom gave her a sad, compassionate look. He would want you to live, wouldn't he? Frankie had lost track of the variations on life goes on that she'd already heard from her mother. The words had become just clanging noises in the empty room inside of her.
Sure, Mom. Right.